Have you ever walked through the valley of the shadow of death, and you know that the Bible says the Lord is with you, but it just didn't seem like He was, and you're going, "Where are you, God?" Even when we are faithless, He is faithful, and He helps grow our faith. So that people can sing, "Never once did we ever walk alone," as they look back. And there are lots of people who could say, "I walked through the valley of the shadow of death and God was with me." Let me tell you about it. Maybe there's someone in the room right now who's in that situation. You're hurting because the ruler of this world has set his sights on you and sin is killing you and your family. Or maybe you have... You placed yourself in a marriage where the abuser is doing his work. Maybe you're a child, and if people really knew what mom and dad were like at home, we too would have questions like you do. Maybe you live in a country where there once was one nation under God, and it seemed like everything kind of made sense. You knew what was right, you knew what was wrong, but you see oppression possibly coming your way, and you're saying, "Lord, what are you doing?" Well, this sermon should give you some help. For you're going to see in the text of Acts 12 a group of people just like us. People that were under abusive leadership. People that were really hurting. But people who went to prayer and God showed up and showed out. He flexed His mighty arm. There's nothing our God cannot do. And may that be our testimony today as we walk through the valley of the shadow of death in lots of different ways, that God would help us be a praying church full of faith, ready to see His mighty hand work. There have been a lot of self-promoters in life. Oprah Winfrey did pretty well, didn't she? Had her show. She got to the point where she had her book club. She had her special food collection. She now is in movies and makes movies. And some have wondered, man, if she ran for president, it may be interesting to see how much of the world might vote for her, because she's a pretty popular figure. She's promoted herself well. We have Kim Kardashian. She promotes her and all of her assets as much as she wants to. Kanye West, fighting for first place with Kim on who's the most popular person. Then we've had Mr. Trump with his ties and his TV shows and his books and his buildings. Somehow that Trump name means a lot to a lot of people. Wait till you see his tweets and wait till you go to his rallies. He's like the king of self-promotion. Yeah, there have been a lot of people who promoted themselves, but no one promoted himself like Herod. Herod was all about him. Oh, he loved his possessions, loved his power, because that helped him get his possessions. He loved his pleasures, and he loved power. But he loved the praise of men. Everything was about, look at me, look how grand I am. And because he was a narcissist, a self-promoting narcissist, he was willing to do anything. He would buy your support if he could. He would bludgeon you if he had to get you to worship him. And because of that, there were a lot of hurting people. Acts 12, verse 1. Let's look first of all at that wicked king, that abusive leader. It says in the text, the text was there. Where'd it go? Oh, there it is. About that time, Herod the king. Just stop. If you heard this, this name would come with a lot of weight. If you go up to the Biltmore House, or you talk about the Vanderbilts, or you talk about the Kennedys, or the Bushes, or maybe even the Trumps now, it's a family that has a reputation, a family whose reputation goes from generation to generation. And this man was a Herod. That Herod name meant a lot. There was Herod the Great, who was one of the incredible generals of his day. He was one who consolidated most of Israel under his reign, which really didn't happen under Roman rule. Rome allowed him to do that. He was a builder who built cities. He built waterways. He built Masada, that fortress. He was the one who built that huge expansion onto the temple. Herod was an incredible man who was able to meander through all of the different political tensions of his day as he kept Rome happy while keeping Persia at bay, while even working within the Jews who normally hated anybody who was ruling their country that wasn't fully Jewish. Herod reigned for 33 years, this guy, Herod the Great. And he severely harmed the people. This is Herod the Great. This is the grandfather of the Herod that we're talking about here. But this is his family. You got to know granddad Herod first. Herod the Great. He was one who would do anything to maintain his power and get applause. It's said that he killed thousands of infants in Matthew chapter 2 because he heard that there might be some new king of the Jews born. He killed his rivals. He killed high priests, a grandfather-in-law, mothers-in-law, brothers-in-laws, uncles, wives, and three sons, and anyone else who just looked at him wrongly. Oh, how he loved himself. He was like Adolf Hitler, Joseph Stalin, Fidel Castro, and Kim Jong-un. He was Herod the Great, who was Herod the not-so-great. But everyone knew his name, and everyone feared him, because he was going to worship himself and take out anyone, anywhere, who got in his way. Well, after Herod the Great was coming towards the end of his reign, he divided up his kingdom between four other people called tetrarchs. Some of their names you may know. There was Salome, Archelaus, and Philip. But the one you probably know next is Herod Antipas. Herod Antipas was that one that was famous for building the city of Tiberias, was really famous for his love affair with Herodias. Remember John the Baptist? He ended up putting John the Baptist to death. And he was the one who had the opportunity to secure justice for Jesus. But like any other narcissistic leader who wanted his own self-interest, he wasn't interested in saving that person that was hurting under his authority. And Jesus was put to death without Herod the king helping. That was Herod Antipas. Well, there was another Herod, Aristobulus the fourth, who is the father of this Herod. Not much happened with him. He only reigned a few short years. He was assassinated. And at this point, Herod's mom and his grandfather, who's still living, sends this Herod, Herod Agrippa, to Rome. They had friends in Rome. It was a dangerous place to be a Herod in Palestine in those days. So he went to Rome, and there he was befriended by the emperor, Tiberius, who was there. There he was protected. There he was educated. And there he maintained friendship with a couple young men, Gaius and Claudius. Both of these men would become emperors of Rome, and both of these men would set him up for success. It pays to have friends in high places. And Herod Agrippa was first given one little small region of Palestine, but he got three promotions. And our sources tell us that his reign was as great, if not greater, than Herod the Great. Herod the Great, if he saw this, would have sat back and said, yep, that guy right there, he's a chip off the old block. He knows how to live up to that Herod name pretty well. And so he did some great things himself. Oh, but he was a self-worshipping maniac who acted just like his grandfather, was incredibly dangerous, knew how to negotiate and politic. And the Jews at this point, the Jewish leaders, kind of liked him. The Jewish leaders liked him because he proclaimed himself to be a Jew, even though he was only half Jewish. The Jewish leaders liked him because he would occasionally get involved in the ceremonies and feasts. There was a time when a Jewish rebellion happened, and Herod went all the way to the emperor and said, please don't squash them. Let me take care of it for you. And he saved thousands of people in many cities. There was a time when the emperor was going to come in and it was going to establish his image at the front of the temple. Herod knew that's not going to go well, and he pled with the emperor, please do not do so. Oh, the Jewish authorities appreciated him. They even let him one time read out of the book of Deuteronomy in one of their synagogue services that talked about the righteous king would be able to read God's law. And they gave him that privilege. Yes, they liked him, but the main reason the Jewish people and the Jewish leaders liked him was because he hated Jesus Christ and the church. And just like Herod the Great targeted all the little babies, and John the Baptist targeted the greatest prophet of Jesus, the forerunner of Jesus, John the Baptist, this Herod said, I am now going to set my sights on the church. And that's what he does. Let's now look at the next verse. The abused people. About that time, Herod the king laid violent hands on some who belonged to the church. He killed James, the brother of John, with a sword. And when he saw that it pleased the Jews, he proceeded to arrest Peter also. This was during the days of unleavened bread. When he had seized him, he put him in prison, delivering over to four squads of soldiers to guard him, intending after the Passover to bring him out to the people. Here are people that are trying to be good citizens. They're in their own homeland. They have come to know Jesus as their Savior. They are worshiping him. They want to have freedom to worship. And yet the government has set its sights on the church with all of the force that Herod had, with Caesar backing him. This is now levied at the church. We don't know who he took out first, but we know who he took out next. James. This is not James that is the brother of Jesus. This is not James that's the son of Alphaeus. This is the other James. It's interesting. The son of Mary, the son of John, son of Zebedee, the brother of John, one of the sons of thunder. If you remember, this James here was once with his brother John, and they were with Jesus saying, hey, who's going to be greatest in the kingdom? Could we have your seats on the right and on the left? Jesus said, let's talk about that for a second. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink? They're looking around wondering, what's he talking about? Jesus says, it's the cup of suffering. And you want to be great, and you might be great, but you're going to greatly suffer, and you're going to have to drink of this cup. That's what happens here. Herod takes out the first apostle that is a martyr. Herod sets his sight on the apostles. Herod takes him out by the sword. Legend tells us, or tradition tells us, that he cut his head off. Herod is attacking. He's the abusive leader, not serving, lording, worshiping himself, harming people. And because it will make him happy to keep the Jews happy, no one who knows the name of Jesus Christ is safe. Well, what happens in the text that you see behind me here? When he does that, the crowds applaud. Oh, that's not good if you're a narcissistic leader, because you'll do anything to get the crowds to applaud. It's like some of our politicians today. They look around and put their finger up in the air to feel the wind because they want to know how to stay in office. They'll do anything to stay in office. They'll reverse positions. They'll vote contrary to what they promised in the primaries. They'll do anything to get your support. Even harm you and harm the people around you if it will help them be king in their own eyes. Well, Herod gets this applause, and he likes it. He loves the popularity. It makes him feel good. It whets his appetite. And he says, I'm swinging for the fences. I'm going toward the top. I'm going to cut off the head. You know who's next? The Rock. That's right. There's this guy, James, that I just took out. Where's Pete? He had just heard Peter was out about. He was up there in Lydda and Joppa and Caesarea. But Peter's come back to town. And so he goes and he finds him. And he has him arrested. But then he slows down for a second. Wait. Why don't I kill him just like I did James? It's the Feast of Unleavened Bread. It's the Passover feast. This is a holy week in the life of Jews. Jewish leaders would prefer me not to take focus away from what they're doing. Don't want to bring sacrilege to their feast. But there are millions of Orthodox Jews who have marched into the city. And you know how you have like the finale at a fireworks show? It's like the biggest grand end. You know how, like, when they had the closing ceremonies, everyone will march in and everyone will just rejoice with their medals on. And it's a big thing. Or like the last night of a political national campaign where they saved the big guns and all the music and the singers and the entertainers and the fireworks for the end. That's what Herod's going to do. Before people leave, when the feast is over, I'm going to put on a show. And all of these people who come and worship, not Jesus, they're opposed to Jesus. All of these people are here to worship God who is not Jesus. They're worshiping according to the old covenant. These people who are here, they know the Christian church is calling converts away from them. And I am going to thrill them by taking out Peter when the feast is over. This was his plans. This is what he wanted to do, all because he loved applause and he hated the church. At this point, Herod remembers something. The Jews had Pete in prison a couple times already, and the last time it didn't go so well. Supposedly, an angel showed up and helped him out, and the next morning he was found preaching back in the temple again. Not on my watch. Pete's not going to best me, and his God's not going to best me. So what does he do? He arrests Peter. He takes him to the fortress of Antonio behind three sets of doors. I would equate that with like the maximum security wing. Then he sets up 16 soldiers to gather around him. Two will be connected to him. Two will watch at the first door. Then we have the second door. Then we have the third door. Two will be chained to him, two at the inner door, two at the outer door, with eight resting. There's always going to be alert soldiers. No one's going to ruin my party. No one's going to rain on my parade. Now, if you're a Christian at this point, slow down for a second. All is lost. I have lots of friends who say the United States of America is done. It has turned the corner. And I have people that are really, really concerned about the state of the church. Like, it's over. It's all hypocritical. It's all superficial. Because it looks really bad sometimes. That's what it looks like here. You have the church without any political power. You have the church targeted by a ruthless, immoral, narcissistic, abusive king, with the full backing of Caesar. You have the church at least not being defended and maybe even targeted by the populace. The populace is in favor of Peter going down. You have the church losing leaders right and left. We've lost Stephen. We've lost James now. And now Peter's in prison. It looks like the Antichrists are winning. They hold all the cards. They're winning the day. Does this sound familiar? Some of you may carry that same sentiment right now. But things are not as they appear. You got to love these next words. Do you see that? So Peter was in prison. So you're hurting. So your nation is in danger. So it looks like God is losing and the Antichrists are winning. But the church is praying. And how are they praying? Fervently. You see, this church is sorely persecuted. This church is crying a river of tears. This church has tons of unanswered questions. Why, God? Why would you have done that to James? Can you imagine consoling Mrs. James at this point? Where are you? How long will you sit by and let the wicked prosper? Don't you care? You can imagine a mother, maybe the mother of James is still alive, going, my boy, God, why would you not have helped my boy, my son? Don't you see how he loved you, how he served you, how he was willing to walk your way and forsake the world and choose Jesus Christ? And yet this is how you respond to him. Lots of questions. But the church prayed, because this is a church that has been devoted to prayer since chapter 1. And the church prayed even though it lacked faith. This is interesting. There's no doubt they lacked faith. They did not believe God would answer their prayer, because when God answers their prayer, they still don't believe God answered their prayer. I'll prove it to you in a second, but let me say that again. This church is praying even though they lack faith. Is that some of us here today? We can sing the big songs. Never once did He leave us on our own. We can talk about the almighty power of God. But yet, even though we believe, our faith is not as strong as it should be. We wrongly listen to the lies of the world, the flesh, and the devil. And what we need is for God to help our unbelief. And that's what God's getting ready to do. But I want you to see this one word up here. They prayed earnestly, and that word is ektenos. That means with energy. That means intensely. This is the same word used of Jesus in the garden. So let me catch you up with where we are. You have this maniacal dictator harming people under his responsibility and his authority. They're really hurting. But man, are they praying. And if God's going to answer their prayer based on their faith, there's no hope. But God, a lot of times, answers prayer of people who just have a mustard seed of faith. And then He comes through. And what does God do to hurting people who are praying people? First of all, God grants peace in the midst of suffering. Let's read together. Now, when Herod was about to bring him out on that very night, Peter was sleeping between two soldiers, bound with two chains, and sentries were before the door, and they were guarding the prison. But notice that one phrase. Peter was sleeping. I don't want to make too much of it, but I do think it's kind of interesting that here is a man about ready to be executed in the morning. Consider his conditions. They're not favorable. Consider his family that he may not ever see again. Consider the slowness of God, who sometimes comes through very slowly and sometimes not at all. Is he going to be beheaded, stoned, burned, or crucified? Jesus had made some strange prediction about him in John chapter 21. He's a man like anyone else, struggling with all the emotions that we would struggle with if we were unjustly imprisoned. But he sleeps. Could that be an answer to the praying people? That they are praying for Peter. That though he walks through the valley of the shadow of death, though his family is falling apart, though his marriage isn't ideal, though he's being done wrong by his business partners, though the spouse is always a pain to be with, though there's a besetting sin, I don't know, but yet God provides peace for people even when he doesn't take them out of prison. Here is Peter sleeping. It's a peace that passes all understanding. It looks like a guy casting all his cares upon the Lord or not worrying about tomorrow. How about you? How about you and your health situation that's going on? Do you know that God, through prayer, can give you peace even when you're in prison? That's what the sovereign God does in response to prayer. He grants peace in the midst of suffering. Secondly, He rescues from suffering sometimes, and that's what He does here. Now, when Herod was about to bring him out, like the tension is there, it's about that time, Herod is signing the order, go get Peter. He's about to bring him out. That next morning, Peter is going to be executed. The Lord sends an angel. The angel shows up with light. The angel wakes Peter up and says, get up, we're going on a walk. Somehow the angel keeps all of the guards, even those chained to him, asleep. Chains fall off his hand. He then tells Peter, dress yourself and put on your Birkenstocks. As they walk, the angel opens the doors. The guards are still sleeping. And then they get to that final door, which looks like walking into the mall, where it just kind of opens automatically. And out they walk. Do you know that this is what God does in response to prayer? That there are times when He rescues you and removes you from your suffering of prison, your prison of suffering. Thirdly, God encourages Peter's worship. The next verse. There we go. When Peter came to himself, he said, "Now I'm sure that the Lord has sent his angel and rescued me from the hand of Herod and from all that the Jewish people were expecting." Peter must have been in some kind of a trance because he seems to be out of it. As a matter of fact, it says he thinks it's a dream later on. But once he's rescued, notice this, once he's rescued without any help of his own, he is then awakened to the reality of what God has done. Hey, that's why we sing. We're a bunch of people who were dead in our trespasses and sins. We were regenerated. We were made alive. We were given a new heart. And our eyes were opened. And all of a sudden, what do we realize? He loved me before I loved him. He saved me before I participated in him. Sure, I have faith. Sure, I'm ready to walk with him. But all I can do right now is give him praise and glory for what he does. And Peter engages in a moment of worship, thanking God, publicly proclaiming that which God has done. This is what God does through prayer. God gives us peace in our prison of suffering. God sometimes saves us. And God grants us the ability to worship. Fourthly, he's God who makes all things right. Oh, wait, he's a God who grows faith. Let's now read. When Peter realized this, he went to the house of Mary and the mother of John, whose name was Mark, where many were gathered together, were praying. And when he knocked at the door of the gateway, a servant girl named Rhoda came to answer. Recognizing Peter's voice and her joy, she didn't open the gate, but ran in and reported that Peter was standing at the gate. They said to her, "You're out of your mind." They said to her, "You're out of your mind." She kept insisting, "It's so." They kept saying, "It's his angel." But Peter continued knocking, and when they opened, they saw him and were amazed. But motioning them with his hand to be silent, he described to them how the Lord had brought him out of prison, and he said, "Tell these things to James and to the brothers." Then he departed and went to another place. Here's a bunch of people with lackluster faith, but with some degree of faith, and they're praying. They're gathered together. And they're praying energetically with earnest. But they don't believe it. When Pete shows up, they argue away what God has already done. I want to believe in faith and prayer more than I do. I want to believe in God more than I do. I want to believe his scriptures more than I do. I want to stand up and preach with greater confidence than I do. I don't have the faith that Christ has given me. I'm not exercising it to the full degree that I ought. I half believe his laws are best. I half believe he's watching. I half believe he loves me as much as his gospel says. But here's my testimony for you. I believe. Not sufficiently. Not good enough. I want to grow in faith. I want the Spirit of God to work it up like fruit. And it's a good prayer for us to pray, like Jesus' disciples prayed. Father, I'm here. I'm at worship. I believe. But can you help my unbelief? Notice one more thing here as well. This may come up in our lives one day. There are times when Peter, there was one time when Peter was released from jail, and then God told him, "Go back right to where you were arrested, and you publicly preach in the temple courts." For him to do anything else would have been wrong. There was a time when Paul was almost killed in Damascus, but he went right back in the city to preach because God told him to. For him to do anything else but stand would have been wrong. There are also times when God told Paul, "Let's get out of here. It's time to escape." And here, he grants Peter the opportunity to be wise, to protect himself. He doesn't have to make a stand right now. He doesn't have to prove that he loves Jesus. He's allowed to leave. and it's not a sign of cowardice or compromise. The Lord grants peace, he rescues, he encourages worship, he grows faith, and he makes all things right in his own timing. Let's look at the end of the story. Now when the day came, there was no little disturbance among the soldiers over what had become of Peter. And after Herod searched for him and they did not find him, he examined the sentries and ordered that they should be put to death. Then Herod went down from Judea to Caesarea and spent time there. Now Herod was angry with the people of Tyre and Sidon, and they came to him with one accord, and having persuaded Blastus, the king's chamberlain, they asked for peace, because their country depended on the king's country for food. On an appointed day, Herod put on his royal robes. He took his seat upon the throne, and he delivered an oration to them, and the people were shouting, "The voice of a god and not of a man." Immediately, an angel of the Lord struck him down because he did not give God the glory, and he was eaten by worms and breathed his last. Oh, Herod, God has been kind to you by letting you breathe his air. God has been kind to you by letting you be acquainted with the Jewish scriptures. Herod knew about Pharaoh, Goliath, Nebuchadnezzar. God had been kind to Herod by allowing him to have a relationship with those Jewish teachers like Gamaliel, who just said, "If this is from God, you can't stop it. I'd be careful." Herod should have learned from his fathers. Herod the Great went to war against baby Jesus and lost. Herod Antipas went to war against John the Baptist and Jesus, but the movement continues. Herod should have learned from his own history. Peter's already escaped once. Now Peter's escaped twice. You would think that a man with good logic would have some pause here and say, "What's going on?" But Herod is totally depraved. He's not able to put the pieces together because he will see the revelation of God and he will suppress it. Why? Because he values himself more than God, and God's revelation is getting in the way of his party. So God shows up and he makes all things right. God is just, and either in this life and for sure in the next life, he will make things right. Peter's miracle causes a great disturbance in Herod. He had this big party shown up. The placards were already out there. Advertisements were going out over the web. But now the news of the morning is Peter, fisherman with pole, bests Herod. Now he's got egg on his face. He's embarrassed. Everything was all set up. It's like Haman with the gallows, but there's no man hanging there. You would think Haman might have learned. You'd think Herod might learn. After how many plagues would it have taken you if you were Pharaoh to learn? But there's just something in the narcissistic fool who keeps saying, "I'm God. I'm going to have everybody serve me, and you get out of my life." And so God comes now, and he shows up. Herod had a little pity party. He ran off to his little town of Caesarea. There he could get away from the press. There he could regroup and rethink. But in the process, Tyre and Sidon make him mad. And he has the ability to really harm them, which is what narcissistic leaders do. They harm people who don't serve them as they ought. But they come up with this plan, and they talk with Blastus, the king's cabinet member, and say, "What if we throw a party like at the Olympics and those games that are played there up in Caesarea?" And they come up with this plan, and it works. They set up the king. They set up his throne. He wears these silver garments that he has. They say, "Please talk to us, O king. We want to hear your voice." He delivers his oration, and what do? A standing ovation this time. He loves this. This is the voice of a man, of God. This is not the voice of man. They call him a god, and he accepts their worship. The Lord sends an angel again, and for the next 5 days, he's eaten with worms from the inside out. He's guilty of murder. He's guilty of harming the church, the bride of Christ. He's guilty of self-worship, and he is struck down. And he still hates God today. and he's still being struck down. Herod, why do fools have to die hard? Why couldn't you just look at the sun, you kings of the earth, in Psalm 2? Why couldn't you just take the knee, bow, kiss the hand, kiss the ring, kiss the sun? Incredible grace comes to those who do. But in the end, God made things right and executed his justice on the abuser. And God is still executing his justice to this day. And how does the chapter end? One more verse. But the word of God increased and multiplied. Saints come and go. Disciples come and go. Kings come and go. But the word of our God and the purpose of our God and the church of our God go on forever and ever and ever. So on the end of this day, Herod is in hell. James is in glory. Peter and the church, they're suffering. They're oppressed, but they're marching on. So how do we wrap this up? Just a couple quick thoughts. I know many are hurting under abusive leaders. And I know many of us are going to hurt under abusive leaders. Do you know who cares? Your church family. Let's go there first. We care. We want to talk with you. We want to counsel with you. We want to protect you. We want to remove you from that situation. We want to call your abusers to accountability and to repentance. We really do care, and we will pray with you, and we don't know how quickly God's going to show up, and maybe he'll grant you peace. Maybe he'll rescue you from this, but we know God cares, and we want to care with you. We will pray with you and love you. But you know who else cares? The one we're praying to. Jesus Christ cares. And how can Jesus help? Maybe you're the abuser. Maybe you're the one who worships yourself. You love your own possessions. You love your power. And you're the one who is going to take it out on anyone who reigns on your parade. And you need everyone to know that you're the man. And when you speak, it's the voice of God, because somehow you've placed yourself up as God in the lives of those that you've been called to serve. This is what happens with egotistical pastors, as somehow we see ourselves as priests, that we now have to stand between God and you. That's not what we do in the Presbyterian church. We're down here on your level, and all we are sinners like you, being abused by the world, the flesh, and the devil, and we'll take you with us to Jesus Christ, who is your only help. We are not men who, by our authority, have this umbrella over you that you're okay under us. No, we are under the umbrella of Christ, and all our job is as servants is to point you to Jesus. That's your job, men, as husbands. You're not to look at your wife and place her under your thumb. All you're supposed to do is get on your knees, wash her feet, and point her to Jesus. As parents, you don't discipline because you're better than your children and they're messing up your testimony or your reputation or your house rules. You love them. You love Jesus. You are pointing them to Jesus with everything you have as those in authority. That's what we do as elders. We're not the royal cabinet who are called upon to make all decisions for the church. We're to equip the saints for ministry. That's what we do. And so if you find yourself being an abusive politician, businessman, husband, father, wife, I don't know, parent, there's hope for you. Paul was an abuser. He repented. He kissed the sun. For the rest of his days, he enjoyed freedom from his sin, a clean conscience, and got to walk in the gospel for the rest of his days. Jesus is watching. He can help. He's the one who can give peace, who can rescue, who can help us worship, who can grant us faith, who will show justice either in this life or the next, and he will not waste your suffering, for he uses it as his word is spread and his kingdom is built. But I know the end, church. Martin Luther said, "And while they understand the devious natures of antichrists, they stand with confidence, knowing that none of these can halt the advance of Christ and his church. Yes, the gates of hell may be greater, ghastlier, and grosser than ever, but they shall not prevail. Though this world is filled with devils, the church will not fear, for Christ has willed his truth to triumph through her. The church of Jesus Christ is like a mustard seed, and it's going to grow. The church of Jesus Christ is going to go from pole to pole. It's going to go from north to south to east to west. It's going to win. And justice will be realized. For Christ will pour out all of his justice on those who hate him. And Christ will take all the justice upon himself for those who love him. Church, let's have faith in what Jesus Christ has done and what he is doing and who he is. And when we lack faith, let's gather together, let's pray, and let's ask him to help our faith be stronger.